now for our What in the World segment. You hear a lot about the enormous threats coming from terrorism, global warming, and Vladimir Putin. But one of the biggest threats facing the United States isn't big at all. Actually, it's tiny, microscopic, thousands of times smaller than the head of a pin. Deadly pathogens.
Fareed Zakaria downplays this moment from a CNN show back in 2017, but it is a little freaky to hear it now. He was predicting a pandemic caused by a virus. Now, as he says in a new book, it didn't really take all that much foresight to imagine one was coming. Over the last several years, we've had other outbreaks. Bill Gates had a similar prediction a few years earlier. And so in some ways, what he said on that show, June 27th, 2017, was just an accurate analysis of the world as he saw it.
I remember it well. I'm a bit of a nerd, and I had been reading stuff in public health literature which was talking about the danger of a pandemic, H1N1 and SARS and MERS. Ebola also was one of those where they were trying to figure out this stuff seems to spread really fast. So I had that at the back of my head. And then I see that President Trump is really trying to gut the public health agencies that would have to fight this kind of virus if it came about.
The budget is called a New Foundation for American Greatness, and it's anything but. Here are just a few examples of proposed cuts. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's budget would grow from $7.7 billion to $6.4 billion, a 17% cut. And the National Institutes of Health would go from a budget of $31.8 to $26 billion, an 18% cut.
I've always been of the view that we don't, in this country, buy enough insurance. I mean that metaphorically. We subsidize people to live on the edges of coasts and at the edges of forests. And we don't spend a lot of time thinking about what happens if there's a flood? What happens if there's a forest fire? That was the context, and we decided to do this segment where we predicted exactly what was going to happen with the COVID-19 pandemic. I got one thing wrong. I said I thought it would originate in Africa, which in retrospect was actually silly of me because all the other ones had, for the most part, come out of East Asia. But other than that, 3 years before it happened, we got it right. But I want to emphasize, it did not take any special prophetic foresight. By then, you had major players in this space, from Bill Gates to the CDC to people like Fauci, who had been talking about this. So we'd had dress rehearsals. They just hadn't come to the United States in full-blown form.
What was the reaction that you got back in 2017 to that? Clearly, people are paying a lot of attention to it now, I have to say. But what was the reaction at the moment?
We did not get much of a reaction because we're very good at thinking about big, obvious, symmetrical threats. We don't spend a lot of time thinking about these kind of strange asymmetrical threats, these things that originate in very small ways. Think about 9/11. We were sitting there worrying about all these big threats. We have 3,000 nuclear missiles all ready to go. And then 19 guys with box cutters wreak more devastation on the United States than any of those attacks, those missiles have done so far. We're not good at these small asymmetrical threats. And that is what happened. We put it out. We got some very good feedback from public health-minded people, some in government who stayed anonymous and others who were very pleased with it. But for the most part, it did not catch on.
The budget based on America First is short-sighted and won't help the U.S. stave off the threat from deadly pathogens. Biosecurity and global pandemics cut across all national boundaries. Pathogens, viruses, and diseases are equal opportunity killers. When the crisis comes, we will wish we had more funding and more global cooperation. But then it will be too late.
By then it will be too late. Aside from just saying there's going to be a virus in the near future here, that element too, you got right.
It was so clear on the basis of, again, those past epidemics that what worked best was the ability for governments to very quickly share information so that you could put in place the right kinds of travel restrictions, the right kinds of tests. But most importantly, we being the United States, we're not just a small country that has to surf on these waves. We could have shaped them. And as you know, sadly, in fact, the opposite happened. The Trump administration had been in the process of defunding various aspects of public health. So we kind of went in the opposite direction. Less cooperation, less involvement in the world. I actually think that that had a lot to do with the way in which this one snuck up on all of us.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Fareed Zakaria is joining us. His book, he says, is not about the pandemic. It's about the world that is coming into being as a result of it and how we all respond. So he's teased out 10 lessons to take from this moment. We won't get to all of them, but we will explore his larger theme that we now all know what a pandemic looks like. We've seen the costs. We've seen the effects. What will we do with the knowledge and the experience now? And the idea came to him almost as soon as the pandemic hit.
I was sitting there in upstate New York trying to figure out what was going on those first few weeks of the lockdown. And I was looking at what was happening around the world. And I thought to myself, this came out of a conversation I had with an Indian businessman who said, you know, 9/11 didn't affect us in India very much. You know, it ended up meaning a few more travel procedures at airports, the metal detectors and things. But it was something between the U.S. and the Middle East. Global financial crisis, none of us had any of those leveraged products, so it didn't really affect us. We got hurt by the recession, of course. He said, this is one where every single person in India is affected. And it occurred to me, actually, this is the first event in my lifetime, and I think in most people's lifetimes, where every single person on the planet is simultaneously affected by this. So I realized the breadth of what was happening. Then I started to think about it analytically and realized that we were in the beginning of a public health crisis, but there was next going to be an economic crisis caused by the lockdowns and the withdrawal of activity. People just not shopping, not traveling. Then there was going to be the kind of debt crisis that comes when governments fall short of revenue everywhere in the world. And so I started spinning it out in my mind, and I thought to myself, I've got to take this further. I've got to try and work out what the world is going to look like, what forces are being accelerated, what forces are being distorted, how will things change. And so I would get up at 6:30 in the morning, and I would start writing. I wouldn't look at any of the news of the day because I wanted to be, you know, kind of 15,000 feet up in the air. And till about 10:30 or so, I would write. And I did that every day for 4.5 months. And that's where the book came from.
So before we get to the actual lessons themselves, I wanted to talk about a few things you mentioned in the book. One thing you say is that if we look at history, that we should have known something like this could be coming. I mean, throughout ancient Greece, for example, you mentioned the plagues they had to endure. You mentioned in Central Asia and in Europe in the medieval time. Give us a sense of what Black Death and the bubonic plague, what that meant for those societies, because you say it varied from place to place, but it does seem to be something that we should have gotten a lesson for if we look at that history, it seems.
Yeah, it's odd that it doesn't figure more prominently in our lives because it was absolutely dominant for much of human history. Because if you think about it, war or revolution was something that in those days, much of history was something fought as set piece battles by armies, you know, somewhere. And then, the numbers of people who were killed was generally related to the numbers in the army, which was not that high a grade at all. It's only when you get industrial warfare, beginning with the Civil War, really, that you have large numbers of people dying in that way. What used to kill large numbers of people for most of human history was not war, was not great revolution was plagues. And so Western literature actually begins with a plague. If you read the Iliad, the first opening verses are about a plague that the god Apollo has rained upon the Greek armies because he's had a quarrel with the Greek king Agamemnon. Mm-hmm. If you look at Thucydides, the first great history of superpower conflict, Athens versus Sparta, he attributes the turning point of the war to a plague which sweeps Athens, destroys a large part of the population, decimates the army, and kills its leader, Pericles, who was regarded as an extraordinarily capable wartime leader. And so it'd be like Churchill dying in the middle of World War II. Mm-hmm. If you look at the bubonic plague, it is probably the greatest effect of any plague in human history. It's staggering to think about this, but this is middle of the 14th century. 50% of Europe died as a result of that plague. So when we look at the numbers now, I mean, it's obviously, thank God, I don't know how anyone could, you can't even conceive of that, right? So you're talking about something like 160 million Americans dying. What it does is it actually ends serfdom because, to put it in a very grim economic sense, what happens is the supply of labor, adult men who can work, declines dramatically. And so the cost goes up. So you can't afford to pay people nothing and keep them on as indentured serfs. And so that's the end of serfdom. But it also begins the Enlightenment. Yeah. Because it was then that people started to ask, if we believe in an all-knowing, all-seeing, and benign God, why did he let this happen? And that begins the process of skepticism and rationalism and things like that. So we've had many, many experiences of it. And of course, the most recent one being the Spanish influenza of about 100 years ago, in which, you know, the estimates are that more people died in the Spanish influenza than in all the wars of the 20th century put together. So it's odd that something that has killed so many people does not really sit firmly in our imagination.
This idea that you mentioned, how the plague created or prompted this intellectual revolution, as you said, the Enlightenment, the Renaissance, the Reformation, in some ways were reactions to those plagues, I found that quite comforting, I have to say. And it seems like that's maybe one of the questions you're wondering is whether this pandemic could provoke the same kind of, I don't know, revolution in some way.
I do wonder, because it does make you think in a more fundamental way maybe than we're used to thinking. Yeah. You know, so I give you one example. We are beginning to realize that a lot of people have been stranded economically in a way that is really devastating to their lives, but through no fault of their own, right? It's, you know, if you look, I mean, New York City, half the restaurants are likely to go out of business. Now, this is not because those people ran those restaurants poorly, because they didn't manage their costs badly, because they were bad business people, because they just had the wrong product for the wrong people. No, it's just nobody's leaving their houses, right? And so all of a sudden you have this devastating impact. So it makes people ask, well, should we in society pool together and do something about it? Should we help these people? You know, and that is the beginning, I think, of a more intelligent conversation about what we owe each other collectively and what we owe each other individually. But there's also a question of internally, what are the internal supports that we need? What helped us get through this? I mean, I know in my case, I have three kids and two of them were actually out of the house, one in boarding school and one at college. And the fact that all three of them ended up coming back was incredibly helpful for me. It suddenly recreated a sense of family that I had thought, you know, not that I had lost, but it was at a different stage. You know, my son was at college and I didn't think I'd be spending that much time, you know, together with all three of them. I realized with a lot of the outer stuff that goes away, the lunches and dinners and conferences and travel, what it was that sustained me. You know, what was it that made me really feel my life was fulfilled? And for me, it was, you know, the reading and research and writing about these kinds of issues. I realized that that was actually much more important to me than a lot of this other sort of seemingly fancier or more important stuff. So, you know, at a, both a, at a larger level and at a personal level, any of the this kind of a shock to the system where you're sort of stripped bare forces you to think.
Fareed Zakaria. He's host of CNN's Fareed Zakaria GPS. He's a columnist from The Washington Post. His new book is 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
When the pandemic reached Utah, we made a promise to provide you with all the in-depth reporting you would need to navigate the uncertainty of 2020. We've kept that promise thanks to the monthly sustainers and other donors who stepped up this year. Now we're asking you to join those who have already committed to support KUER. Make your pledge of support today at KUER.org/donate. And thank you for supporting public radio here in Utah.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer and CNN host Fareed Zakaria is with us, here to talk about the lessons we all should be learning over these last 10 months now. The pandemic, he says in a new book, hasn't reshaped history as much as accelerated it. The world after the coronavirus, he says, is just a sped-up version of the world we knew. So how are we all going to respond? His book is 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. Lesson one is, as the chapter heading has it, buckle up, that we have created a world that is always in overdrive. Human development has been dramatically accelerated. That's the essence you get at here. And I wanted to tease out one of the particular points you make in this section, because you mentioned that this crisis could be thought of as nature's revenge. Explain this, because I think this is an important point. Wildlife markets and the destruction of natural habitat, that's part of what you're getting at here.
Yeah, that phrase, nature's revenge, by the way, is the Pope's. He mentioned it in response to the pandemic, and it got me thinking, because in a sense, human beings have developed this arrogance that says we can just keep developing the way we are developing, keep accelerating our development. And we don't need to think about what effect that has. We are continuously, in a sense, asserting our dominion over all other species, over the natural habitat. And as you say, that process has really gone into overdrive in the last 30, 40 years, ever since the collapse of communism, which then resulted in everybody in the world embracing globalization, capitalism, markets, technology, which all produced enormous growth, by the way, got a lot of people out of poverty, hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. But in encouraging and accelerating that kind of growth and dynamism and development, we didn't think about what effect that was having on the planet. So, you know, we continue to denude and destroy the natural habitats of a lot of wildlife as we develop out. And it turns out this pandemic probably happened at some fundamental level because of that, because the natural habitat of the bat was getting destroyed. The bats start living closer and closer to human beings. Bats have lots of viruses for complicated reasons. And the viruses in bats start jumping species and landing in, you know, in pigs or in chickens or in pangolins. And those are then eaten by human beings. And thus the transmission goes from bat to human. Another one which I worry about, the next pandemic, is likely to be because of the explosion of factory farming that has taken place in the last 30 years. I mean, at this point, 99% of all meat sold in the United States is factory farmed. And I'm sure some of you have seen the videos of this, but it is gruesome. You take thousands and thousands of cattle or chickens and you herd them together in unsanitary conditions. And the virus then hops from animal to animal, gaining strength. And by the time you're at the 25th, 1,000th animal, you now have a very potent virus. And all that has to happen is it makes that last jump. Or as I was saying, you know, you think about forests and the way in which you allow human beings to live so close to the edge that these sparks that come from human existence, you know, forest fire, campfires and things like that, can easily become a forest fire. this year in the United States, in the last 4 months, we saw burn to the ground 5 million acres of land. That is the state of Massachusetts on fire. So all of this is nature's revenge, you know, and one of the things I think we need to understand, there is a certain arrogance we have, which is that we'll be all right. Somehow nature will take care of us. Well, nature has no special fondness for human beings. There's a great scientist, Joshua Lederberg, who makes this point. Nature is just a series of chemical reactions. If you push too hard, too fast, you can end up with a chemical reaction, a physical reaction that you will not be able to control. And that's my real fear in that chapter, which is I really want us to understand we're living pretty dangerously, and it wouldn't be difficult to live in a more sustainable way, to build in some resilience, to buy some insurance. And we need to think in those terms going forward.
Lesson two in the book is an important point you've been making, that it's not the quantity of government that matters, it's the quality. Now, if I understand this right, what you're saying is that the old order that used to organize political thinking was basically this. The left said the government should have a larger role in the economy. The right said, stay out of it, let the market, you know, basically run free. So the debate was about that, was about the size and the role of government. That is, you know, the quantity of government. But you say that the pandemic has revealed that what matters most or should be is the response for the quality of government. Explain that point.
Yeah, this came to me, I have to confess, by watching the countries that did best over this course of this crisis. And they were all in East Asia.
Maybe you could mention the conversation you had with, the vice president of Taiwan.
That's exactly right. The Taiwan, as I say, Taiwan gets the gold star for this crisis. I mean, 24 million people in Taiwan, and they have had 7 COVID deaths. Yeah. Just to give you remind you, New York State, where I live, has 19 million people, and I think it has 36,000 deaths. Mm-hmm. The United States per capita will have 2,000 times as many deaths as Taiwan has had. And it's not Taiwan alone. It's Taiwan, South Korea, Singapore, even Hong Kong, if you look at by itself, Vietnam. What struck me about these governments was they don't actually, they're not huge bloated governments. This is not a case where, you know, the government owns everything or anything like that. In fact, if you look at the classic measure of government, which is the percentage of the state as compared to the GDP, it's much lower than in the West, much lower than the United States even. If you look at their healthcare spending, Taiwan spends 1/3 as much on healthcare per capita as the United States does. So what's going on? So I realized, as you say, that debate we've been having is a kind of 20th century debate is really not relevant in the 21st century, because everybody understands you need markets, but everybody understands you also need some degree of regulation and some degree of, you know, you need courts to adjudicate property right disputes and things. That's not really the action is in a different place. The action is what government you have. You want it to be really efficient, focused, directed, staffed by good people, and most importantly, that there is a level of trust between the government and its people. Mm-hmm. And what's striking about those East Asian countries is they have much smaller bureaucracies than the United States. They're lean, they're mean, they're efficient, they're filled with really smart technocrats. The government is still an incredibly prestigious profession. In Singapore, for example, they pay governments at the equivalent of private sector wages. So a minister in Singapore will probably make $1.5 million. And by doing that, they make sure that it's incorruptible, it's highly competent. And there is a huge amount of trust between the government and people, because the government is also very, you know, very careful in how it communicates. So when you told people, wear a mask, social distancing, all that, nothing ever becomes politicized. Nothing turns into this kind of strange cultural war that we're having here. So, part of the challenge I think we're having is looking at the West, we have lost that ability. There are some countries that have it. Germany still has it. Denmark has it. You know, there's some countries in Northern Europe. Canada, interestingly, has maintained some of it. But certainly in Britain, the United States, and a lot of Europe, we've lost that. The government is dysfunctional, it's deadlocked, it's divided, and people don't trust it.
Well, it's on the right and the left, you mentioned. I mean, on one hand, you talk about how conservatives and certain populists, you know, have this mistrust of what they call a deep state, that it shouldn't be trusted at all. It should be even dismantled. But you also mention that this problem comes on the left as well, that how left-wing politicians have added layers and layers of bureaucracy and regulation. So it's both of those things that's at play, it seems.
Absolutely. This is it's like a pincer movement. The right, we understand ever since Reagan and Thatcher, they're just a constant droning of defunding, dismantling, and also disrespecting government, demeaning the people who are there. Reagan used to joke, the 9 most scary words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Mm-hmm. So there's that tradition, which actually has taken its toll on federal agencies and on good government. But on the left, you have this this piling on of mandates and requirements and diversity quotas. And not that any one of those is not appropriate or understandable, but if you put it all together and you put yourself in the position of the person trying to run that agency, it's essentially an unmanageable task because you've been given so many mandates and they often conflict with one another. We've made it harder for government to execute than in many other advanced industrial democracies.
There's another interplay between the good and the bad of the right and the left in lesson 4 I wanted to ask. And here's lesson 4. People should listen to the experts and the experts should listen to the people. So let's start with the listening to the experts part. But this requires what you say is a deeper understanding of how science works. Talk a little bit about this, because you say a lot of us think science is just one definitive answer, but it's not that. It's a process and we don't understand it.
Yeah, I think when we think about science, we tend to think about it. There's two things we think about. One is kind of sexy pictures. You see a telescope has taken a picture of this galaxy. And the other is some very big dramatic moment, the Nobel Prize, somebody discovers something, somebody invents something. But those are really snapshots, whereas what science is a very long movie. And the movie is one of constant error. You try an experiment, you fail. You try another one, you fail. Edison was once asked, was he regretful that it was only on the 1,000th try that he got the light bulb right? And he said, no, because I learned that there were 999 ways not to make a light bulb.
Right.
And that's what science is, that you're constantly trying and you're getting new data and you're moving from there. So when people would ask for an answer from some scientist regarding the virus, and then they would say something, and then 2 weeks later it would turn out to be wrong or different. You started to hear this crazy conversation. Well, Fauci doesn't know anything. The CDC doesn't know anything. First they said masks were bad. Then they said it's good. First they said you could get COVID from surfaces. Now they're saying it's airborne. Well, look, they were learning as we were going along, and they were using past history of past viruses to try to understand it. And then they would test and say, if you look at the surfaces, what happened was initially they tested the surfaces and the virus was on the surfaces. Then they did further testing and they found, yes, the virus is on the surface, but in very small quantities, not enough to really infect you. But that the airborne transmission is very potent. Somewhat different from previous viruses. So with each one, you're learning. And one of the problems the scientists have to, is also they need to take off their white coats and sit down and explain this process so people understand, so people understand we're on this journey together. We're trying to understand it. As we get new information, we will tell you more about it. Not as though there is some kind of miracle moment where you have the answer. I think that part is, I don't know if I would fault the scientists, but I think we need to have a more educated conversation about science in this country. People don't understand it, and there is a tendency to just imagine that it's like the Delphic Oracle. You turn to a scientist and he will just give you the answer that is true for all time. Science has never worked like that, and it never will.
Well, and you say that the public can and will grasp this nuance if you're just honest with them. You present it to them in an honest way. And this idea of public officials in this country, scientists and the elites, speaking down, condescending to some in the American public is an important sort of point that you get at. And because you mentioned that the real reason people aren't following the advice of experts in some ways is it almost seems cultural in some ways. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, to me, it feels like it's a kind of class war almost, right, where one of the it's gotten wrapped up rather in a class war that is already underway. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest divides in America right now, and it's not just in America, we have a sharp version of it, but it's happening really around the world, is this big divide between educated and less educated people. And I don't even like to use that word because it makes it, there's somehow a kind of value connotation there. I think that there was an article in The Atlantic magazine that put it well. It said that the big divide in this election was density and diplomas. In other words, if you lived in a densely populated area and had a diploma of some kind, you were likely to have voted for Joe Biden. And if you lived in a sparsely populated area and did not have a diploma, you were likely to have voted for Donald Trump. But it gets at this larger cultural issue, which is that the people on one side of that divide who live in sparsely populated areas and don't have diplomas deeply resent what they see as the kind of arrogance of this credentialed urban elite that is always telling them what to do. I'll give you an example of this. It came after Trump got elected. Somebody pointed me to a blog post that a very articulate, smart guy had written. I think he lived in rural Mississippi. And he said, if you want to understand the anger that produced Donald Trump, think about my life. I live in a rural area in the South. Every time I turn on my TV, I'm looking at people in some cool city, and in a sense, subliminally, we're being told that is what's cool and that's what's celebrated. Every time I go to a movie, it's set in New York or San Francisco or Chicago. Every time I hear a song, it comes out of one of those cities. Every time I hear about a new trend or a new technology, it's all from that world, from that world's perspective. Imagine what that makes me feel about my life and who I am and who my family is. And I think that that sense of this deep alienation between the urban and the rural, the credentialed and the less credentialed, is much deeper than we realize. And the anger felt by people on one side of that is much greater than I think we've realized. And so the advice being given by experts, by scientists, started to get interpreted that way. It should never have happened, but once, if I can be honest, once Trump politicized it in that way, yeah, and said, this is the same bunch of know-it-all experts who, you know, tell you that you should eat kale and do yoga and, you know, all that kind of thing. All of a sudden, you created this sense of distrust and this sense that of a kind of symbolic defiance that became almost a kind of cultural marker. Mm. And it's so tragic that what was really public health advice got caught into this cultural divide. But it tells you the power of this cultural divide and the depth of that resentment.
Yeah. But well, you keep saying, and I just think as a way of reminding people, we do need more experts, not fewer. But they need to be taking greater pains, as you say, to connect with people. And there's this thing you write that I think is really important to remember. It's a question you ask in the book. That is, not to think about how the elites, people think about the elites, but how elites think about people. And I was really struck by this question of whether this sense of elitism has in some ways short-circuited empathy for some. And you mentioned this this study at Berkeley. Would you mind mentioning this?
Sure. What's fascinating about, and there have been a series of these, but they all have, roughly speaking, this quality, which is you tell a group of people, randomly selected, that in some way you are more elite than the other group.
Yeah.
And what you find is that those people very quickly develop a sense of complete disregard and a lack of empathy for the so-called non-elite. You know, you choose an in-group and then you create an out-group. And very quickly, the in-group decides that they are superior to the out-group. What that tells us is, you know, this is very potent stuff. This is part of human psychology, sociology. I mean, we are in some ways hardwired to want to create that sense of separation. And then you add to it the kind of meritocracy we have in America right now, right? Which is that we do a lot of stuff based on testing and grades and all that. And look, I don't know any better way to do it. You know, I mean, the old days it was done on the basis of were you a, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant and did you, you know, have the right family? And that certainly was a terrible system. So, but the danger of a meritocracy is that you tend to believe that you deserve your higher status in society or your greater income or whatever it is that you have, and that you, and by implication, that the person who didn't, you know, who isn't in that position, who didn't get that job, who didn't get those grades, who didn't score as high as you is on the SATs, that person also deserves to be where they are. And that, I think, is toxic. And I think that one of the, this is, you know, the reality of life is much more complicated. Yes, you have some talent. Yes, you worked hard, but there was also a lot of luck involved. Your parents might have helped you. The place where you happen to be born or grow up might have something to do with, right? Warren Buffett often points out the greatest lottery that he ever won was the lottery of birth, that he was born in the United States and not Bangladesh. I mean, with his talents in Bangladesh, he might be, you know, pick, you know, it might be a field hand in a farm. So not having, you know, and I sometimes think, I'm not a particularly religious person, but I think the waning of religion has some role to play here, because in the, you know, one of the fundamental things that religion, most religions teach you is that in the eyes of God, we're all the same. And we've lost that sense. You know, I really do find when you talk to people who are super successful in America today, they think they deserve it. And I don't want to detract from those people, but I want to remind them, you know, first of all, there was a lot of luck involved. But secondly, you're not morally any better than the person who just, for whatever reason, is worth, a fraction of what you are. We are all morally the same.
One of the lessons is that inequality will get worse. And you mentioned how, you know, pandemics are supposed to be this great equalizer. But in this section of the book, you say, you know, inequality will always be with us. And you mentioned how money, for example, that can buy a better house or a better car. That's one thing. But we're in a situation now that money can also now buy, as you say, preferential treatment and favors from politicians. And this could be corrupting and corroding. And it seems like this is what we're seeing right now. Is that why inequality will get worse, according to that lesson?
Well, I think it's getting worse because of the pandemic. I mean, because the pandemic is, you know, it's one of the upsides of the pandemic is it's made it, it's accelerated digital life. And digital life is a life that can be lived in large part without need for the sort of physical, the realities of life. But that's only available to a certain group of people, right? I mean, the people who can manage their lives and generate the same income, roughly speaking, that they were able to tend to be businessmen, lawyers, consultants, accountants, doctors, journalists, academics. But if you work in a restaurant, a hotel, a theme park, a cruise ship, a casino, a retail mall, this period has been like the Great Depression for you. So that divide is getting worse and worse. But what you're referring to, which I'm so glad you point to, because it's the thing that I think is so important to understand, is the inequality combined with the kind of marketization of everything. Everything can be bought and sold. Everything can be bought and sold. Means that it's fundamentally not just about a bigger house. It's about, you know, being able to have a higher quality of democracy for yourself, right? So think about what it means to have money in America today. You can donate money to your congressmen and your senators and your mayors, and they will be more attentive to you and your concerns. You can go into any public space, a baseball stadium, and you will have preferential seat treatment. There is a whole kind of cordoned off world for you that you can experience in a way that other people can't experience, even within what are meant to be public facilities, public areas. There's a great line in the movie Jerry Maguire where this woman is, struggling, and she's traveling somewhere with her son, and the son asks her something because they look at first class. And the mom says to her son, she says, honey, first class used to be a better meal, but now it's a better life.
What's wrong, Mom?
First class is what's wrong, honey. Used to be a better meal, now it's a better life.
That's what's happened. We've created a world where everything can be, doctors, for example, famously never give you their phone numbers. Well, it turns out if you pay them a yearly fee, many doctors will give you their phone number. So, there are a whole set of new rules for people who can afford them in politics, in economics, in daily life, in socially, and that creates, that means that in a democracy, all citizens are actually not really equal. And that, that cuts at the core of what a democracy is meant to be.
I do want to ask you about lesson six, which, as you put it, Aristotle was right. We are social animals, because this gets us to what is the modern city going to look like? You mentioned in the book you have an affection for cities, big cities. You grew up in Mumbai, big and boisterous and dirty, you said. You like the vitality of a frenzied, existence in a city. What does a post-pandemic city look like, do you think? Will cities change?
They will change. I think that this is an area where, in the past, plagues have always emptied out cities. The bubonic plague emptied out the cities of Europe. But then very quickly, people moved back once the plague, and it never really completely went away, but once its worst effects dissipated. For example, Florence was the epicenter of the plague. And within 70 years, everyone had moved back and they were creating the Renaissance, which really begins in Florence. In London, they go through plagues and fires and they build back better. They turn the city of wood into a city of bricks and stone, which is the city we now see when we go to London. But this time it's different because of the digital aspect. You have the ability to get lots of things done without having to travel. But I think that what we will find is that there is that impetus on the one hand, which allows you to work from anywhere. On the other hand, there is a very deep human urge to congregate. We congregate for all kinds of reasons. We congregate, first of all, because you still make more money if you're around lots of people. That is one of the reasons why people have always gone to cities. And whether you live in the suburb or whether you live in the city center is less important. The point is you want to work with other people, because the competition and collaboration that comes from being in those densely populated metro areas, it just means you have more opportunities, you see more things, you learn more things. And that is a very old pattern. And I don't think that goes away. The other piece of it is we have always wanted to congregate together to mark our existence as human beings in communities. We worship together, we mourn together, we celebrate together, we socialize together. I quote Aristotle, who says man is a social animal. And what he means by that, he goes on to point out, is human beings are best fulfilled around other human beings. This has always been the case. He uses the metaphor of the bees and a beehive. And I think that that's very deep hardwiring. I can't imagine one pandemic will change that. And so it'll be some kind of hybrid. I do think people are going to recognize they don't need to go to the office 5 days a week at exactly the same time. And that model, by the way, is a recent one. It's a couple of hundred years at most, maybe even 150 years. Before that, you know, farmers lived on the farms and tradesmen lived in there. The shop was above the store. So there's always been more of a home life melding together. What we think of the city nowadays, we think of, you know, that image that comes out of that TV show Mad Men, where you live in the suburbs, you leave your home area in the morning, you go to your work area, which is 30 miles away, let's say, or 20 miles away, and then you work there, and then you come home in the evening, and those two worlds are completely separate. Well, that's a very recent phenomenon. We're much more likely to go back to a model where, you know, you're working at home some, you're working at the office some. The office may not be, you know, people may not have dedicated office cubicles the way that they have now. It may be more something like the WeWork model. You know, ironically, the company might have failed, but their model might succeed. But I do think at the end of the day, we are not going to want to be sitting isolated by ourselves with minimal human contact. And look, we've done that for the last 6 or 7 months. And I think most of us feel like, yeah, this is fine. And it's interesting, but we all look forward to actual human contact.
Mm. Let me ask you this finally. You point out early in the book that, you know, even if our economic or our political situation does eventually return to normal, as human beings, you say, we are going to be changed by this because we have, as you say, we have been through this unusual, really difficult trial, and we all came out of it. And you mentioned this novel by William Maxwell, They Came Like Swallows, about a man who survived the Spanish flu in 1918, that era, that he felt this, you say, the sense of wonder that had stayed with him, that it had been like going through that with everyone else had been this revelation, because he had no idea his life would have been like this. That sense of wonder, that sense of us being through this thing together, say something about that, if you would, finally.
William Maxwell, a great novelist, was himself a child when the Spanish flu happens. And the searing image in his life was that he lost his mother. And yet he writes this novel where you have this sense, even though you had tremendous loss, you have this sense of having come out of something, of having survived something, of having new horizons and new possibilities because you have survived that. We're now in the thick of it. We are still in the midst of a pandemic. But when we come out of it, there will be a sense of new opportunities, of relief, and, you know, a kind of collective sense that we went through something together, the way people felt when they went through World War II together. Imagine the people in America who just went through the war rationing and the difficulties and such and came out of it. I think we are going to have some such moment where we take stock of something we have all gone through together. This is why leadership is so important. We have to take these moments and take these trials and make something good of them. One of the great, great virtues of that generation come out of World War II, they came out of hell and they decided they were going to build something better. And they created the United Nations and the Global Trading System and all these agencies and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So there is a way out. And I think we can't quite see it yet. But the most important thing is, what will we do when we have that new sense of possibilities? Will we really do something better?
Fareed Zakaria, thank you very much.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you.
Fareed Zakaria, his new book is 10 Lessons for a Post-Pandemic World. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Ivana Martinez, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.